yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3075 et al. United States of America versus Jose Antonio Celis, also known as Calvo Appellant. Ms. Hernandez for Appellant Anibi Valderrama, Ms. Alita for Appellant Jose Antonio Celis, and Mr. Redereta for Appellant Juan Diego Giraldo, and Ms. Mongavero for Appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Carmen Hernandez, and I represent Ana Yibe Valderrama. Your Honor, my client did not receive a fair trial, as that word is comprehended by the Bill of Rights and by cases from the Supreme Court and from this court. I would hope this morning that I give the court a bit of flavor of what it was like to represent this woman in this trial.
I mean, I suggest, counsel, well, this is only a suggestion. You only
yes,
have
sir.
10 minutes. I would focus on what you think are the most important issues you raise, the ones in which you think the government is most vulnerable, because the briefs are enormous.
They are, Your Honor, and that's why I would hope to give you a flavor.
Let me get the flavor from reading the brief.
Okay.
Why don't you focus, if my colleagues agree, focus on the real key issues you think you can bring, legal issues.
And if I can help you,
yes, sir.
The issue I'm interested in is the Confrontation Clause argument.
Yes.
And here's my question about it. The Confrontation Clause doesn't give you an absolute right to comprehensive, unbridled investigation to prepare for cross-examination, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well, I want you to help me understand what limits the Confrontation Clause does place on the trial court's ability in a difficult situation where you have safety of witnesses concern. What sort of limits are placed on the trial court?
There were two different violations in connection with the Confrontation Clause. There were errors that the court made in restricting confrontation, period, in limiting questions, refused to allow with respect, and to answer Judge Silberman, I will focus.
That's your weakest argument, isn't it? I think you would start with your strongest. I mean, we have to give a wide swath of room to district court judges to fashion cross-examination. Right?
Well, the judge repeatedly, explicitly said, government, you're running into trouble. I'm letting you do this. I'm letting you run your case. It'll be for another court to decide.
What I was trying to get at was the use of pseudonyms for witnesses.
Isn't that your biggest argument?
That's not my issue, but I will try to address it. I'm not the person.
Everybody's joined.
I understand.
What were the two issues you wanted to focus on in your argument today?
Your Honor, the problem was the pseudonyms were bad, but we could live with the pseudonyms if we had received the production of Brady materials in advance of trial and if we would have gotten the, yes, sir.
A second. The presiding judge asked you, what are the two issues that you specifically want to raise today?
The combination of errors that prohibited a fair trial.
All right.
Which included confrontation and Brady violations.
All right. So in your brief, you say that the government withheld production, specifically with regard to Valdez.
They withheld production with respect to every witness. They explicitly said at the pretrial hearing that they would withhold until it was clear that there would be no continuances. They said those words.
I'm not sure I'm following.
Are you talking about Jenks Act material?
No, I'm talking, well, I'm sorry.
Radiant.
The government's position was, we had thousands of pages of pretrial discovery. None of it related to Valdez, to Moreno, or to Lechuga. None of it.
Right.
As to Valdez and Moreno, they weren't even mentioned in any of the pretrial discovery. Each of them had admitted criminal conduct unrelated to my client. And that was not produced. That was clearly Brady. Each of them had given, Moreno had
All
tortured
right,
him. Excuse me.
As to, I think it's Moreno, there were prior convictions, but the government's brief says, well, Mr. Moreno, the witness, claimed that there was a mix-up of names. So my only point is that what's the prejudice?
Well, that's exactly the point. The government gave us redacted, in the middle of trial, redacted prior records of this gentleman with his supposedly Colombian identification number. And redacted, I mean, his true name was redacted out, so it was not a full document. Four priors, including fraud and including drug trafficking, unrelated to my client. When I confront him with him, he says, no, I've never been convicted. The government then produces the originals. There's a discrepancy in the names that prohibits me from confronting him directly. So not only are we left with this pregnant pause that he did not have four priors because he denied it, but I have now spent a bunch of time cross-examining him on something that he now says I didn't do, and I can't confront him and say, yes, you did. Not only did you do it, but you're lying about it. And all of this is because the government, we don't have his name, and they have refused. And Your Honor, I would say this is clear Brady. It's Brady slash Giglio. Prior convictions are the type of thing that you can confront with. They had a DEA 6 where the gentleman admitted to having tortured a human being unrelated to my client. And none of this.
But if it's not the witness on the stand, you couldn't have gotten anywhere with it, is my point.
It was his conduct. He admitted the torture. But he was a man who had been fired from the police force after 10 years in the force and claimed that it was for no good. It had nothing to do with being a bad cop or being a liar. We had no way, we were precluded from investigating, Your Honor. There was a protective order that precluded us from disclosing his name or the name of any other witness to our investigators in Colombia without leave of the court, and the court never gave leave.
All right, as I understand the concern here, it's that the government turned over the Brady and Giglio materials 5-6 days before the witness testified.
Not always. They pissed me off. Two things that happened.
No, let me just finish my.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
They claim that they turned the materials over, say, like the Thursday before the witness was going to testify the following week. And I thought part of your concern was that all of this material was coming so quickly that, as a practical matter, it was impossible to digest it, much less prepare for effective cross-examination.
That was one of the major concerns. It was coming to us in its original language. If it was Spanish, it was coming in Spanish.
Now, the judge said early on, there are not going to be any continuances.
He repeated that. That was his mantra.
All right, but here's what I need to understand, is the judge says, here's how I'm going to conduct the trial at the beginning. At that point, you had filed a pretrial motion for Brady and Giglio. At that point, the judge says something like, well, the government says it's going to turn it over, and I'm sure it will. Did the judge say anything further when it became clear that these productions were not coming consistent with the judge's understanding at that point?
He, as I said, explicitly several times said, government, you're running the risk of losing this case on appeal. I'm giving you free rein. He literally said that. He invited, and he continuously, he would say things like, I feel your pain. And I'm not disrespecting the judge. He's a wonderful judge. He just felt that he was not going to give a continuance. He made that clear.
Are you saying it was error not to give a continuance?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what case do you rely on for that?
Well, for one, there's a Fourth Circuit case that we cite in our briefs, and that's Jenks, not even Brady. Brady they have to produce immediately, and they did not.
The district judge noted that Valdez was not telling the truth, did he not?
Well, that's prejudice. After trial.
Well, it may or may not be prejudice. The point is that he recognized that Valdez didn't. Now, Valdez's explanation was he didn't want to reveal his true name.
That was not the only problem. I mean, he out and out lied about having given a statement in 2003. And this is not just lies. This goes directly to his substantive testimony.
All right, but on cross-examination, you brought that out before the jury, that there were these conflicts. And as I understand it, What you point our attention to is the fact about this header with the year 2003. But I must say the government's response to that is quite strong. In other words, that the jury was already aware of this contradiction. And what wasn't the jury aware of had you known about the 2003 header?
Well, it was an out-and-out lie. The Valdez statement, if I'm able to articulate what happened.
It was an out-and-out lie. Were you able to make that point to the jury?
Well, no, that's the point. I didn't notice the header until after trial and sentencing, when I had time to sit and look at these documents. The document, and that's only one of the documents that was produced with respect to Valdez, is at page 1218 of the appendix. It's single-spaced, 7 pages in Spanish. I'm a Spanish speaker. I was born in Cuba. But I have been in the United States since I'm 7 years old. Spanish is my second language at this point. And these are dense documents. Every person identified in these documents has 2 first names, 2 last names, and 2 AKAs. It was impossible. And I will tell the court that none of us were ever able to sit down with the multiple statements that particularly Valdez. Valdez had given multiple statements. None of us were able to say, okay, in statement one you said X, in statement two you said minus X, in statement three you said Y. None of us.
The government says Valdez was not a crucial witness. He was just confirming and corroborating testimony that we had both through other witnesses and through physical evidence.
The government fought to have Valdez on the stand. The judge multiple times suggested to them that he not be put on the stand for multiple reasons. Valdez is the person they identify in rebuttal as my witness. You know, the government always says,
no, I understand that, but I mean, what was crucial about his testimony?
He was the only one. He was a member of the FARC. He claimed to have been her bodyguard. He put her traveling up and down the Caguan River, delivering cocaine picking up cocaine and delivering billions and billions and billions of pesos, which even in the exchange rate, we're talking about millions of dollars. According to him, there were a total 140 trips that he took up and down the Caguan River with her. None of his testimony, Your Honor, was corroborated by any evidence whatsoever or by other witnesses.
Well, but the government says other witnesses testified to your client's involvement in providing the drugs for distribution to the United States.
There was
not that there was corroboration of the river trips necessarily, but there was corroboration as to the involvement of your client.
3 witnesses mentioned anything from one could infer that she knew that the drugs were coming to the United States. Valdez claims that on her orders, he buries U.S. dollars. What he now knows are U.S. dollars. That's one item. Lechuga claims that she travels to Panama to meet with a co-defendant whom, according to the government, could not even talk to her anymore, and there was a threat out on him because he had not paid off money. And at a time when they've stopped shipping cocaine because of air interdiction activities that the Colombian government, there's no evidence that she left the country of Colombia. The government, the pretrial discovery is that in fact she never traveled through a port of entry in Colombia. There was a year surveillance in Panama by the Panamanian authorities. My client was never observed there. The way they followed them around is they had their phones tapped, and when they arranged to have a meeting, they would surveil them. This meeting, where my client supposedly was in Panama, was never surveilled because it was never overheard on any telephone call. No, in fact, Rocio Alvarez, the woman who knew everything, and there was so much, the court allowed her to testify on the theory, on the exception to the confrontation clause and the rules of evidence known as common knowledge.
Is it your position there was no negative evidence against your client with respect to the conspiracy?
If you take out these witnesses, which I think you can, the residual case, Your Honor, if the court will, I wrote out what the residual case is. That is the case that we know was corroborated or was not lacking of confrontation. When she was arrested, she had a few pesos in her pocket, religious icon, and family photos. They seized a computer at her brother's farm. There was no financial information. They seized some cocaine at her brother's farm. It was unprocessed little packets, which the Colombian prosecutor admitted came from his store, and this was an area, and every...
You're saying there's no probative evidence at all if you, that you're prepared to concede, suggest your, or tends to prove that your client was in a conspiracy.
If you eliminate...
No, I just answered the question yet. There's no probative evidence at all as far as you're concerned.
No, the witnesses, these witnesses that I claim were not confronted and all the other problems.
All that evidence goes out. So there, and as far as you're concerned, there's no probative evidence.
Let me, Joint Appendix 185, there's a video, which of course we claim was hearsay as to my client because it was not in furtherance of the conspiracy. There's a video in which the snitch or the cooperating witness is eliciting all sorts of information from one of the co-defendants. JA 85, that's a page of the transcript. The cooperator says, yeah, I talked to her being my client. And she refers to a conversation that she had with one of the co-defendants, not the one she's talking to on the video. And that's what, so Calvo said these words to me, says the cooperator. He said, yeah, I talked to her and I asked her for some time and she told me that she'd already told co-defendant one that she didn't have anything to do with that. So the government's evidence, the cooperator is relating a conversation that she had with one of the witnesses, with one of the defendants, in which she's saying she has nothing to do with that. The DEA agents admitted that she was caught on 11 phone calls. They introduced three. The DEA agent admitted that they caught her talking about an X-ray machine, other medical genes, and non-drug-related items. Your Honor, there was no evidence, untainted. The residual case, Your Honors cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what I believe the standard is, when you find a constitutional error. You cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt that the residual case supports the guilty verdict. You just cannot. And if the court has any questions about the facts and how many documents they produced and all of that, I would ask the court to send the case back to Judge Robertson for findings. They produced discovery in a without a cover page, without bait stamping. Every morning I'd come into court and there was a pile of documents on my desk, redacted with numbers corresponding to the witnesses.
All right, but courts have acknowledged that may be the circumstance defense counsel faces with regards to Jenks statements. You come in and, you know, there's boxes of materials.
First of all, this wasn't Jenks, Your Honor.
No, but I'm getting at the point. Some of your objections are talking about the Jenks material.
Well, the parts that were Jenks was not produced, but this was not Jenks. Every single item was either inculpatory. It was Giglio materials. In some cases, there's clear case law that says if the person, this document that's in here, the one with the header, the reason, this is the way I proceeded in this case. I would look at the documents. I'd see if I found her name. And then I would look at that paragraph. That's the extent of what I was able to do. And this document, 7 pages, single spaced, talking about the FARC, talking about his activities, mentions her in the last page and unrelated to any drug trafficking. This is a man, by his accounting, had been with her day and night, traveling up the Caguan 140 times over 2.5 years, and not a mention of that in a 7-page, single spaced, under oath document, which, by the way, says that it is a document provided as he is being reinserted into society, which means he left the FARC, and this is in September in 2003. His testimony is that he remained in the FARC until 2005, past the time when she was arrested in 2004. He's her bodyguard, but he's not with her when she's arrested. He's her bodyguard, and he's not in Panama. Excuse
me. To show, as the district court said at one point, that the rest of the government's case was so rotten to the core that the failure of your ability to cross-examine here you know, made the difference in the case.
Completely. And as I say, I mean, the judge...
The 140 river trips weren't addressed or corroborated. I mean, the government's point is there are all these other witnesses who testified where, as far as I can tell, you're not objecting that you didn't have a fair opportunity to cross-examine them.
Oh, absolutely not. I am objecting, from pages 19 to 23, every fact witness was in the same shoes. Every fact witness was in the same shoes with the same multiple documents. On Moreno,
your argument to the court is that as to every witness, fact witness, Brady disclosures were late, Brady disclosures were incomplete, counsel was unable, because of time constraints, given the fact that there were no continuances, to adequately prepare, even though we do know that the judge did give you a couple of continuances, two of the witnesses.
No, he gave a continuance to Moreno, and what he did was, he said, okay, you can cross-examine him 4 days from now, but in the meantime, we're going to put four different witnesses on. So it was insane. You know, they gave us six CDs, untranslated, untranscribed in Spanish, of testimony of Moreno, which I believe, and which I tried to cross-examine on, explicitly contradicted his in-trial testimony. CDs in the middle of trial. They stood up and said they hadn't had them transcribed because it would have cost $50,000. We're CJA counsel. They had three government attorneys, a law clerk, multiple DEA agents that came and went. And they couldn't do it, but we were supposed to do it in the middle of trial. My client was unable, as to Moreno, they gave me a DEA 6. I had it translated. I gave it to two court translators. And even though his testimony was delayed by 4 days, by the time I got the document back, translated so my client could read it, he was off the stand. So I don't have any, I'm not allowed to do any investigation. I'm not allowed to interview any witnesses. And my client, the only possible source of information for me, can't even help me. I was not able to see her once during the trial. It's a combination of factors. Your Honor, I've been a public defender. I'm in private practice. I do CJA cases. I've been practicing for a long time. I started my career in 1982 as a law clerk to a federal district court judge. I've seen a lot of cases. I know that we have to practice under strenuous circumstances. I have never in my entire life, as I told the judge, been involved in a case of this magnitude with events outside this country where I was completely handcuffed. I was not an attorney as the Sixth Amendment requires me to be, I must say. I'm sorry to say that.
All right. Let's see, how are we proceeding here? We're going to hear
from... I apologize, I'm way over my time, I think.
No. The court had a lot of questions. Thank you. Why don't we hear from counsel for Appellant Sillies?
Good morning. My name is Elita Amato, and I represent Mr. Jose Antonio Sillies. The two areas that I presented to the court in my brief related to variance as well as the introduction of hearsay in violation of the federal rules of evidence. In terms of the variance argument, the argument is basically that there was a variance from between the charge that our clients were charged with and presented with, and then the evidence that was presented.
The government's basic argument there is a single conspiracy was charged in the indictment. They put on evidence to prove that, and even if there was evidence going to other conspiracies, because of the instructions to the jury and the jury's finding, basically your argument.
There's no prejudice.
It's not persuasive, yeah.
Well, I disagree, and I disagree because I believe the...
I need to be clear on the law.
Yes.
This circuit, so far as I have found, hasn't decided this precise question, but at least one other circuit has, I need to know what your view of the law is on this. In other words, you charge one indictment, you put on evidence of six indictments, you instruct the jury that they have to find one conspiracy as to each that each defendant is a member of one conspiracy, and if they can't find that, they have to acquit. And at least one circuit, as I read it, has said that's sufficient to meet any legal objection.
Well, I don't
believe... Why should we not adopt that approach is, I guess, my question.
Well, I think the court still needs to consider and take a look at each case to see whether the jury instructions are adequate for that particular case.
Well,
and I would submit...
Was there any challenge to the jury instructions in this regard?
I don't recall if we specifically challenged the jury instructions as they were...
The instructions are very clear to the jury that they have to find a single conspiracy that your client was a member of, and if they can't find that, they have to acquit.
Your Honor, it's hard to believe how the jurors could have not been affected by the spillover effect of hearing the evidence of all the other conspiracies.
Haven't we ruled that when you have a small number of co-defendants, the spillover effect is unlikely?
Well, there may have been...
We've got cases that say there were 10 defendants and there was no spillover from there. We've got a small...
I understand that,
number that, here.
That in this case, the number of defendants is small, but the number of conspiracies, the number of different schemes was not small. The government seems to list 7 different schemes, but I believe that there was more than that even. There were certain schemes that were brought out...
Dovetailing with Judge Rogers' question, why doesn't the instruction take care of that here? Instruction's clear. If you're going to convict someone, you have to find them part of a conspiracy that they're a part of. It can't be someone else's.
Well, instructions, certainly the instruction is something that we hope will take care of that, and that's the reason the instruction is there, but it doesn't mean that in every single situation the instruction is actually able to take care of the problem and deal with the issue. And I don't believe in this particular case that the instruction was able to deal with the issue because
what should the instruction have said to take care of the issue? In what ways?
Well, I don't know if the instruction could have. I really don't think in this case the instruction could have. I think the error was permitting the case to go to the jury. I think the judge should have... been much more stringent on the government and precluding the government from introducing the evidence. Even the judge admitted that there was a variance in this case. At one time, he said that the conspiracy the government was trying to prove was as big as the country of Colombia.
That's not the end of the inquiry for us, right? A variance doesn't mean per se that there's error that's occurred, does it?
No, not per se, but
what is the legal standard we're supposed to use?
Well, the legal standard, of course, is to determine, first of all, when the charge is a conspiracy, whether there are multiple conspiracies that have been in, the evidence has proven multiple conspiracies as opposed to just the one conspiracy charged in the indictment, and then to determine whether or not that the transference of the evidence was such that it has caused a defendant to be found guilty based on all the totality of the evidence.
Is your best argument that your client, at least as to the latter part of the time of the conspiracy, had withdrawn from the conspiracy by that point so that the jury could not properly consider the previous evidence of his alleged participation in the conspiracy?
Well, no. Certainly there is an argument that he had withdrawn from the conspiracy, but I don't believe that just because someone withdraws from a conspiracy that then one cannot look at what he did prior to that. But my argument is that it wasn't just one long conspiracy, that the information that the government was soliciting from their witnesses dealt with various different conspiracies. We had individuals that were not charged in this indictment. There were individuals that had no relation to my client. There were acts, each of these different acts that they produced evidence of did not rely on the success of the others. In fact, some of these were not successful. And some of these, like the MAPA, which Moreno testified at length to, wasn't even something that occurred. It was something that was just talked about in a meeting. So there was no interdependence, and I think there needs to be interdependence.
The fact that it was just talked about in a meeting doesn't mean it's not evidence of a conspiracy.
No, I understand that, but I mean, in terms of, again, the interdependence of, and this, there was no need for, the success of one conspiracy or scheme did not rely on the success of the others. I mean, in some of the cases the government presented in their brief, there was this sort of reliance on the activity of other acts, and so therefore it was considered to be one conspiracy. In this case, that was not the case at all, because some of these things weren't even brought to fruition. Some of the acts that were testified about were unsuccessful. So there was no interdependence.
That it's a, I'm putting words in your mouth, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but your position is that the general law regarding conspiracy does not allow proof of multiple conspiracies that simply are cured by an instruction at the end of the case, and that this circuit should not adopt that approach?
I think the circuit needs to take a case-by-case look, and that's what I'm urging the court to do, that in this particular case, that...
No, I'm trying to draw you out so I understand what the legal principles are here.
Well, again, I understand what the court is saying, but I believe that the court needs to consider each case separately to determine whether or not...
I understand it. The government says the conspiracy here is to bring these drugs into the United States for a profit. I mean, that's a very broad umbrella. And there are lots of different acts that they prove to say that this is all part of this umbrella. And since you have arguably a single source, although in one of your arguments you point out that there's no proof of the source, you have enough evidence here of a single source that everything else is just a spoke around the wheel. And that's sufficient to prove a spoke and wheel conspiracy.
Well, actually, it's not, because there has to be a rim, as the cases of Kotiakos and Tarantino.
But the government's rim is bringing drugs into the United States for profit.
Well, no, I believe the rim needs to be interdependence between all the participants and not just that.
What's your best case on that?
Sorry?
What's your best case on that?
I would say Kotiakos and Tarantino. The other thing is that initially coming into this case before the trial, our understanding of the conspiracy was a conspiracy that was charged between Mr. Celis, Ms. Valderrama, Mr. Giraldo, and Mr. Fabian Ramirez relating to the 1400 load.
Yeah, but that all got cleared up at trial. I mean, the prosecutor said, no, here's our theory, here's our...
Well, at trial they did, that's right.
No, but I mean, when there was this discussion going on, when the judge inquired, you know, is it the 1400 or is it something larger?
Right, and I guess that kind of goes to Ms. Hernandez's argument that, again, that was something that was surprised and presented to us at trial, because going into the trial, it was our understanding, based on the discovery that we had received, the discussions that we had with the government, the affidavits in support of the extradition, that this conspiracy involved just the 1,400-kilo load. And then when we went to trial, it evolved into this larger conspiracy, as, again, the judge said, as large as the country of Colombia. And
your other issue was the... Introduction of the...
That's right. The other issue was the hearsay issue, and that was the introduction of the video statement as to Mr. Celis and Ms. Valderrama. It was the video recording between Mr. Giraldo and the government's witness, Rocio Alvarez. And the government introduced the video pursuant to 801D2E, that it was a co-conspirator statement in furtherance of the conspiracy. However, at the time that the video was made, Mr. Celis was no longer a conspirator, and as well as Mr. Giraldo. I mean, the evidence that the government actually presented was that there was a threat by Ms. Valderrama and the 14 Front against Mr. Celis. There was also threats against Mr. Giraldo because of this loss of the load.
Does that always end a conspiracy? Can't conspirators get upset at each other and make threats?
I suppose they could, but there was, but certainly the way the evidence appeared was that because of that, Mr. Celis could not deal with these people, and therefore Mr. Celis was trying to find other people to obtain drugs from and cocaine so that he could continue to at least do what he needed to do in that regard. So although in some cases it may not end a conspiracy, but in this case, it certainly didn't end the conspiracy. And in addition, at the time, or the statements that were made in this video were certainly not in furtherance of the conspiracy. They dealt with...
Don't we have case law that says that when one conspirator is reporting to another the nature of the transactions between them in the past, which seems to be what's happening here, just sort of recounting of what's going on, that's actually in furtherance of a conspiracy?
Well, first of all, Ms.
You need to be talking about things prospectively all the time.
Well, Ms. Alvarez, who was the other participant in the video, was not a conspirator at that point. She was actually working for the government as an informant. Number one. Number two, there is case law, though, that if it's historical information, it is not necessarily in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Not necessarily, but it might be, right? I mean,
well, it might be depending on what else is provided in that statement, but in this particular statement, I believe it was just primarily historical information. There was nothing that Mr. Giraldo was seeking to engage in by having the statement for further future action. He was not seeking that Ms. Rosie Alvarez would undertake certain future action based on what the statement was that he provided.
But I mean, that gets to the point. We don't need to find, the trial court didn't need to find that the statement was talking about what was going to take place in the future. You can be talking about, you can be giving an account to someone of what's taken place in the past, and that be in furtherance of a conspiracy, right?
Well,
it seems that you want us to draw a rule that we haven't been willing to adopt before.
No, in my brief, though, I do. There are definitely cases which talk about if it's historical in nature, and if it's just historical, that then that is hearsay, and that is not in furtherance of the conspiracy.
All right, counsel. Thank you. Okay. See, we'll hear from counsel for... Mr. Giraldo.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Manuel Retoretta. I represent Juan Diego Giraldo. Taking the court's suggestion, I will focus on two of the three issues that we have raised. We raised issues regarding audio tapes that were introduced, but to pick up where the discussion left off with Ms. Hernandez regarding the pseudonyms, kind of blending in what happened with Jenks. We were dealing with, and we are dealing with now, and we will continue to deal with cases involving an international component. This is one of the first. This is one of the first that we had that dealt with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, dealing with not just necessarily going into Colombia, going into Bogota, but dealing with a region of Colombia that was at one time under rebel control. There was a demilitarized zone that we were dealing with. There was an area that the army had just taken over. I raise these issues because what was happening with the production of evidence was not only something that we dealt with, and when I say we, the defense, it was something that the good gentlemen and ladies at this table over here dealt with also. There were numerous instances when Mr. McNeil would come to us and say, we've just received this. Because they are not working with DEA agents. They are not working with FBI, who they can get on the phone, stroll down the street, and say, hey, look, we need that DEA report. They have to deal with the embassy. They have to deal with the judicial attaché. They have to deal with the Colombian National Police, the Colombian Army. And when we get into the world of the civil war that we were introduced to in this case, they have to deal with front-line units. Example, Mauricio Moreno.
You're making.
Right, where does this take us?
It's taking us to Mauricio Moreno as an example. Mauricio Moreno was an example of a witness that was introduced to us. Mauricio Moreno is a witness that now in another case that is currently before Judge Hogan, who initially had our case, has... His identity has been revealed in that case. But the manner in which these witnesses were revealed to us does not allow us to properly investigate. We were dealing with...
Are you making the pseudonym argument?
We're making the pseudonym argument. We're making the release of Jenks information also. The pseudonym argument deals with our inability to properly investigate witnesses in Colombia. As an example, Mauricio Moreno. Once we received that information, we were exposed to a witness that had questionable activity and had left law enforcement in Colombia under questionable circumstances. We could not investigate those circumstances. I can tell you now, because I'm involved in another case, and this person has been revealed to us, that we are now able to investigate that person, and we are beginning to find out things that are things that we would like to have had in this case.
You needed to be able to investigate him.
We would have needed that
name, and you were allowed to tell one person in Colombia the name, right?
We would have needed more time. We would have needed more time, and we would have needed the freedom to tell numerous people. I say that for the following reason. In Colombia, when Mauricio Moreno, or a person that is a classified reinsertado, someone who was a member of the FARC and now comes up and says, I'd like to leave the FARC and I'd like to be reincorporated back into society. When they do that, they come in and they are brought before the military initially. The military then uses them and presents them to various cases that are currently being investigated. So as an example, Valdez was brought in, was probably held, we don't know this because we don't have the background, but was probably held at a military camp, and the authorities at that camp would say, we have case 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. We want you to tell us about all these cases.
I'm still trying to understand what your point is, counsel.
My point is that
you didn't have sufficient time to investigate Moreno back in Colombia.
Right. My point is that witness provided statements. Ms. Hernandez was discussing a statement that Valdez issued. We were able to find a discrepancy in that statement. That is just the tip of an iceberg that we feel exists with these witnesses. So we are not able to go back and say, wait a minute, Moreno.
You did conduct cross-examination for these folks. What was the basis for your cross-examination?
Their direct testimony. Their direct testimony and whatever documents were provided to us. But what the documents that we were not able to investigate, the documents that we did not have, was the other testimony that person had provided in other cases. Compare, here we are in the District of Columbia. We're here before Judge Robertson in a case that involves something that happened in one of the quadrants of this city. We have Witness X. We as defense counsel can immediately stand up and say, Witness X, I know Witness X. He testified in U.S. v. so-and-so, U.S. v. so-and-so. Pull the transcript for that. We could not do that here. We cannot do that because we were initially hobbled by the disclosure of the witness, the delayed disclosure in that.
Non-disclosure.
Well, at times, well, disclosure, because we received the name at one point, but it was late in the proceedings.
So, in other words, it's late disclosure.
So what you say you need more time. How much more time? I mean, what would have been? Well, you began your discussion with reminding us of what a mess things are in Colombia and how difficult it is for anyone to put on a case here, relying on witnesses in Colombia. So what's the answer here?
As an example,
about an abuse of discretion standard, right? How much discretion should the trial court have had?
As an example, we can see the progression from our case to one of the cases that we have now. In our case, it was the Thursday before. In the case that we're now moving for with Hogan, it's 30 days.
Counsel, don't bring up another case. That's just going to confuse the issue. So please just focus on this case.
In this case, it was Thursday before. We couldn't do it. We couldn't do it in the middle of trial.
As Judge Griffith points out, doesn't the trial court have an enormous discretion on this issue?
It does.
How can we conclude? What case should you point to, allowing us to or suggesting that we should conclude it was an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, because the cases are so new. Because the concepts of what we're dealing with international evidence in areas that are difficult to find, difficult to get to. One of the things that we have discussed is, well, there is the world of Brady. The world of Brady teaches us we need that information in time so we can make effective use of it at trial. This is a perfect example of not having the evidence in time.
Give me a practical answer. What would have been correct for the trial court judge to do here? You say you need more time. How much more time? Do you need more days, a month,
no, months.
2 months,
talking
6 months?
Probably at least 3 months.
3 months.
At least 3 months for us to be able to get that information, make the contact in the foreign country, have the investigation done there, and be ready for trial here.
Better never hope to try one of these in the Eastern District of Virginia.
Well, not to test Judge Silberman's patience, but the Southern District of New York has discussed that 30-day time period to play with.
But let me ask, was all this presented to the district court judge in this case?
It was.
And a proposal made along the lines that you've been discussing with Judge Griffith?
No, I mean, we were told the rules.
In other words, the government, I'm sure, is going to get up here and say, you know, a lot of evidence was released as much as a year earlier. And as soon as they got the information, they were turning it over. And so that's the way the cookie crumbles, as a sense. But I just didn't find this type of analysis. I understand there's lots of discussion by defense counsel saying we need more time. It's impossible for us to investigate. It's impossible for us to fulfill our professional duty as defense counsel. But the judge had announced early on no continuances. And while the government's motion in limine asked for a broader bar, the judge didn't buy that. So you did get the names. I realize it's a tight time period, but you got the names. You had the opportunity to speak with the witness. Yes, I know you say you didn't have, but you actually did. Your problem was you wanted to speak to the witness alone, and the government says, well, the witnesses didn't want to speak alone to defense counsel. That's sort of a different issue. So I just want to go back to where I think Judge Griffith may have been, and that is the notion that if in an international terrorism case the government has evidence to suggest serious concerns about the witness's safety, the district court can impose certain restrictions on the defense, but the district court has to make, you're just saying that as a matter of docket control, the district court has to have a series of pre-trial meetings to go over all of this, and then what did you tell Judge Griffith, 30 days or not? A 30-day continuance.
3 months.
3 months, 90 days. That's what I had in my
90
mind.
Days.
Yeah,
90 Thank you, Judge Griffith.
and allow defense counsel an opportunity to see what's out there, if anything. Yeah.
Because what we were learning in this case revealed the difficulty. Mm-hmm. Rocio Alvarez for Juan Diego Geraldo was the key witness. Rocio Alvarez, we were not able to investigate how many other cases she testified in. Rocio Alvarez, for us, we were able to decipher and uncover that she had done some shady things just with her interaction with the DEA. But Rocio Alvarez, if we were able to properly investigate her, I have no doubt that she would have appeared in numerous cases. And I have no doubt that in those
What is the legal standard here? What is the law here? What are we supposed to be looking at in reviewing the abuse of discretion argument you make? Clearly there must be law here that governs how we're supposed to think about how much time that you're to get to be able to investigate the background of witnesses.
I wish I could point to something, because I think we're some of the beginning cases. We're some of the cases that will follow up with cases out of Afghanistan, cases that will come to us.
But I mean, we have other cases that talk about fundamental principles of cross examination. You have to have a reasonable ability to cross-examine, right?
Certainly. The Crawford confrontation. But I think it does get down to discretion. I think what we're still dealing with here, we were learning this. We were finding this out, and the judge did not take that action.
Discretion. We need to know what the baseline is so we can decide whether the judge has abused the discretion. So what is the baseline?
Well, for the facts of this case, The abuse came when once it became apparent, number one, that we were hobbled by a protective order.
Hobbled by, so is that the standard, when you're hobbled by a protective order?
No, nobody.
At least you need to help this judge come up with what the standard is.
Is your argument that the protective order was erroneous?
Yes. We should have been able to inform anyone and anyone in Colombia to investigate this.
That's what I took as your biggest basic argument here. And that goes back to the pseudonym question, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the argument you presented, or one of you presented in your brief, is that since there was no evidence your clients had threatened the witnesses, it was inappropriate for the court to allow synonyms.
Exactly.
The government's response to that is, gee, what's the difference? If whether it's your clients or some others have threatened them, or isn't that enough of a reason to use synonyms?
No. Which then leads us to the quick question, no. But it leads us to the third argument that we have, which involves the severance issue. Because we're making a jump. We're making a jump from Mr. Celis, Mr. Geraldo, to Defendant Valderrama. We're making a political, ideological, organizational jump. And that is the FARC, which is what we deal with in the severance issue that we were dealing with, trying to combat, fight off evidence relating to FARC. Now,
why didn't the jury instruction on that take care of it? I thought Judge Robertson was very clear on that.
I don't know. I know that we have a decision in the Palmera-Pineda case that has concluded that evidence of that nature was error in that case. And it was classified as error for someone who was a card-carrying member of the FARC. Now, take that.
What was the site for that case?
That is the, it was just recently issued. And the name is
Pineda?
Pineda, yes,
all
Palmera
right, yeah,
Pineda.
I have that site, thank you.
Yeah.
But it was harmless error.
It was harmless error, but it was classified error for the card-carrying member of the FARC. Mr. Geraldo was not a member of the FARC. And the list of information that was alleged against Mr. Palmera Pineda, when you compare it with what was put against, was put into our case, terrorism, guerrilla activities. FARC expert came in to talk about what was happening with the FARC in Colombia, leadership of the FARC, inner workings of the FARC,
all
atrocities.
Right, so getting back to where I think we may, or at least I'm struggling, to find an abuse of discretion by the district court, I gather you are asking this court to hold that if the district court is going to impose a limitation on the disclosure of the identity of government witnesses, there has to be a reasonable amount of time for the defendant, once he learns the name of the witness, to investigate. And that where you're dealing with the difficulties of international investigation, just as the government has the problem of getting information. So there must be a period of time in which the defense has the opportunity to investigate, and that's just a bar. And failing to allow that type of opportunity is an abuse of discretion.
If I may continue on.
Is that what you're asking?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
If I may continue on Judge Rogers' question, isn't the necessary implication of your argument that the pseudonym cannot be used? Because if a pseudonym is used, and then you have 3 months to investigate the real person, once you've given them a real name, what the devil's the purpose of the pseudonym? So basically, your argument comes back to the proposition that the pseudonym is erroneous in itself. And you don't have any law in support of you. You have cases going the other way.
We have, in response, my response to Judge Rogers was going where you were going. Number one, we should be given the names to start off with. When we get the ground rules set for us, then we need something at that trial level to be able to effectively confront that witness.
Well, you had the names. The restriction was your ability to tell others about it in Columbia, right?
The restriction and the time constraints.
In other words, the judge's amendment to his order on January 29th simply came too late. That was the order that allowed you to disclose the name to one person in Columbia.
Right. We didn't have enough time to take care of that. And we were dealing with...
It's not the pseudonym. It's not the restriction on disclosure of the name. It's the time.
No, it's the pseudonym. We should...
Of course, that's the point I made in my question. If you have 3 months to invest... If you have John Jones as a pseudonym and you're told in advance of trial that John Jones is really John Smith, and now you have 3 months to go investigate John Smith, then what the devil's the purpose of the pseudonym?
That question goes back to the government. Judge?
Then your basic argument is the pseudonym itself cannot be permitted.
So the government...
It's not the time. It's the pseudonym itself can't
be permitted.
Well,
the time is the consequence of what happens with the pseudonym.
Well, of course. They're inextricably intertwined.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
I thank the court.
And let me say, I'll give a couple of minutes to each appellant counsel, but let's hear from counsel for appellee.
May it please the court, Mary McGavro on behalf of the government. I respectfully ask this court to affirm the appellant's convictions. While the appellants have raised numerous issues on appeal, I'm going to focus on 4 of those issues, specifically discovery, the requests for continuances, the use of pseudonyms, and the variance argument. First, I'd like to discuss the discovery argument. Valderrama is not entitled to a new trial because the government did not violate its Brady or Giglio obligations. The government provided 18 rounds of discovery in this case, and all impeachment evidence was disclosed. And that's
about timeliness.
Yes, Your Honor. The timing, if I can set it out for the court, on the very first day of trial, redacted Giglio was provided to the defense. And then...
How about pretrial Bagley? Brady, I mean.
Your Honor, there actually was no Brady at issue here, and that's because there was no exculpatory evidence, and defense counsel fails to point to a single piece of exculpatory evidence in this case. However, it was Giglio.
Exculpatory evidence under Brady includes impeachment evidence, counsel.
That's correct,
Your Honor. There was lots of Brady here. And the government...
That's Giglio.
No, Giglio, I thought, was where the government makes promises to the witness. But what's the post-Brady case that talks about, Brady covers impeachment as well?
That's correct, Your Honor, and we submit that this was impeachment evidence.
We've been talking about impeachment evidence here.
Yes, and we believe that impeachment evidence was provided to the defense with sufficient time to effectively make use of it at trial.
And where are we going to find the precise time?
Well, it's set forth in the record, for example, on
the record is huge.
Joint appendix pages 70 to 71
right.
Lays out when the redacted versus unredacted Giglio was.
That's where the district court is talking about, I'm sure the government's going to turn this over.
And the Giglio was provided. For example, let's take Moreno. It was provided on January 22nd, and then on January 25th.
The trial started January 8th.
Yes,
I'm defense counsel. I'm trying to prepare my case. I am entitled, says the Supreme Court in Bagley, to have the government help me prepare my case. I need this evidence before trial.
Well, Your Honor, they did have evidence before trial, and on the first day of trial, all the impeachment evidence was given to defense counsel.
First day of trial? I'm trying to get my defense together. Well, I mean, this is not new law, counsel.
Your Honor, if I may, yes. The first day of trial was January 8th. The first substantive witness was not called to testify until the 17th.
I'm talking about Brady evidence.
So, again, Your Honor, they had...
You're not arguing to me that the Supreme Court has stepped back from its view of the government's obligation under Brady, are you?
Oh, no, Your Honor, and we submit
right,
that
so
we
let's
disclosed...
talk about before the trial.
Well, Your Honor, the Brady case law recognizes the fact that there can be, as long as the evidence is disclosed, that there's no error under Brady except...
Bagley, counsel?
Well, Bagley held that they would have to be able to make effective use of it at trial and that there needed to be enough time to do so.
Getting it on the first day of trial is not helping defense. I mean, I'm surprised we're even having this discussion, counsel. The Supreme Court law is clear on this.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, the issue here was protecting, balancing the rights of the defendants with the security issues that were very serious and palpable in this case. And so the evidence was provided to defense counsel with sufficient time for them to review that evidence and make use of it at trial.
Well, we have statements by defense counsel in the record to the district court that they couldn't possibly review this evidence in the timing that they were allowed.
Well, at that point, Your Honor, the district court did not abuse its discretion in the sense that it granted a continuance.
It gave two witnesses.
It gave...
defense counsel makes the point, and the government doesn't dispute this, that, you know, those continuances came at the time that they were getting other evidence and the trial was going on with other witnesses.
The district court also clearly stated on the record that it would give defense counsel as much time as it needed to investigate, and that can be found at Joint Appendix page 604. Also, the district court made it clear.
What was the context of that statement?
The context of the statement was that it was in discussion to Mr. Moreno's testimony, and defense counsel made it clear that they were having difficulties reviewing the material. The district court noted that he would give defense counsel sufficient time to investigate. There actually was an in-chambers discussion in which, for Mr. Valdez, there was a discussion to gain access to certain people to help the defense counsel investigate, which was done, and that can be found at Joint Appendix page 664. Moreover, as the district court noted on the record, counsel was to come back and inform the district court if they needed more time or more information.
Okay, and I'm still stuck prior to trial and the government's Brady obligations, and you still haven't answered my question.
Your Honor, the answer, I suppose, is that it was provided
but
with sufficient time.
Trial.
Not on the first day of trial,
not
before January 8th, Your Honor, that's
what is
correct.
What is the government's explanation for that?
The explanation is that some of the materials were just becoming into its possession and they were turning them over as quickly as possible, which the record demonstrates.
All right, but the government had prepared its case. It had some materials. So, I mean, the government has never denied that there weren't materials that it was obligated to disclose as Brady. All I'm trying to get is to is the timing of the disclosure. And you're telling me they got it on the first day of trial.
They got redacted Giglio on the first day of trial.
Why couldn't they have gotten that much earlier, consistent with the government's obligation under Brady?
It was because of the security issues at risk.
These are redacted. Redacted materials.
Well, if they were unredacted at that time, I think that there was concern about the security, so that they
so
gave the...
You just told me they got redacted materials, and I'm asking you if they're redacted.
And then the unredacted materials 7 days before each witness testified.
So are you telling me that the government turned over unredacted materials prior to trial?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I apologize.
No, that's all right.
What was the question? Could you repeat that, please?
Yes. Did the government turn over redacted Brady material prior to trial, prior to January 8th?
Your Honor, I don't believe that they did, and that's because they were trying to get the materials from Columbia. And as you can see
let me just say, that's not what the record shows. It shows the trial prosecutor telling the judge that they're prepared to turn over this material. And what I was trying to track down is when was the material actually turned over prior to the day trial started, namely January 8th?
That's when all the materials were provided on the first day of trial.
That's the first time defense counsel received these materials?
The impeachment materials, yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Now,
want to go on to your second point?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, before I continue on, just to point out that defense counsel had...
Before you go on...
Yes, Your Honor.
To take Judge Rogers' point, what do you take as the law on that proposition that you can turn over Brady material or Brady impeachment material, not the direct exculpatory material, but the Brady impeachment material, you can wait till the date of trial? Do you have any case on that?
Your Honor, I off the top of my head, I think the case law says effective use at trial, and I think that...
Does that necessarily mean, as Judge Rogers is suggesting, that it had to be earlier for investigative purposes?
Your Honor, we submit that it doesn't, and that's because the record clearly establishes that defense counsel was able to make effective use of this material. They were able to review the documents. They were able to impeach their witnesses with these statements. For example,
argument basically there was error, but it's not prejudicial?
No, Your Honor, we submit there was an error because that they were turned over with sufficient time. First of all, they were disclosed, so there's no Brady violation there. And
wait a minute. There is a Brady violation if it's turned over too late, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the next point is that it was turned over with sufficient time to make effective use at trial. Therefore, there was no violation.
Maybe I misunderstood, but I thought opposing counsel argued that cross-examination was conducted solely from direct examination. Is that wrong?
I believe that the record, that is wrong, and the record states otherwise. They were able to make use of the impeachment materials. For example, Mr. Moreno was impeached by the use of the DVDs of which they complain. A further example is that they were able to use Mr. Valdez's statement to impeach him, both about the length of time that he spent in the FARC, as well as the lack of mentioning Valderrama's drug trafficking activities, including going up in the river and burying money, and all of those things were brought out both on cross-examination and re-cross-examination. And therefore, defense counsel cannot establish any prejudice here because that they were able to impeach using the very statements that they were provided.
So I am very clear about this. The government's position is that there is no obligation to turn over impeachment evidence prior to the first day of trial. Is that the government's position?
I believe, with a small caveat, that in where there are security issues, that yes, that would be.
You told me that there was redacted information. That takes care of the security problem.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the case
that is
law.
The government's position. I just want to be very clear.
To turn that over with sufficient time to prepare.
That the government's position is that it has no obligation under Brady to turn over impeachment evidence in redacted form prior to the first day of trial.
Your Honor, I would have to say yes, that is the position in this case.
I want to be very clear about that.
Your actual position is the answer is yes, only if they have effective use of it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that all turns on whether they had effective use on it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
it would
submit
be less likely if substantive witnesses were going to be examined on the first day or second day. But you're saying here it was much later, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. For example,
see, there are two issues. One is the obligation to turn over. Then two is the question whether or not it was turned over late and there was any prejudice. But I'm at the first question. All right, and that's okay. What I wanted to be very clear that what the government's position is on that.
It's that.
All right.
And if I may, again, the first substantive witness didn't testify in direct until the 17th of January. So that's 9 days into trial. Moreover, trial sat for 4 days out of the week, so that there it was a minimum of 3 full days to review any Jinx material, all the Giglio material. And furthermore,
and all the Brady material. I mean, you're treating Brady like Jinx.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that it's Brady slash Giglio in the sense that this was impeachment evidence. And
I understand that, but in terms of your disclosure obligations, you're treating it basically like Jinx, that the trial is going to start tomorrow and I get the materials tomorrow.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully submit that the record establishes otherwise, that they were given the Giglio at least at a minimum of 7 days, 9 days. Example, joint appendix page.
Into trial.
Well,
but as far as preparing their case and their defense, they don't get any Brady evidence before trial starts. I mean, that's your position, I gather.
Your Honor, we that is our position, but we submit they were also given 18 pretrial rounds of discovery. They had the ability to prepare a defense. For example, Ms. Alvarez, they were provided that video between Ms. Alvarez and Mr. Geraldo, the very first discovery package, in May of 2005. Mr. Geraldo referred to Rocio Alvarez's real name at the sentencing. They knew who these witnesses were, and they were able to conduct an investigation. And moreover, they were given the surveillance notes from Panama.
These witnesses were.
In the sense that that if they reviewed the discovery material, they'd be able to figure out who the witnesses were.
Were just a charade?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that they weren't a charade, that the security issues were real here, and that's why the protective order was in place.
But
yes.
You're saying if they looked at the discovery materials, they could figure out who the witnesses
were.
Well,
I was pointing to Ms. Alvarez was an example, and that was who Mr. Geraldo complained the most about on new appeal. Well, I still believe it was necessary to protect her name from the press and from other, you know, the release of other her name publicly.
I mean, there are ways that judges can take care of media publicity.
Well, and Your Honor,
I'm talking about the prosecution obligations to the defense. That's all I'm discussing.
And they were met here, Your Honor, and
all
that's.
Right, I get your point.
And if I may just quickly about the request for continuances.
Right.
I'd like to point out the fact that the requests were either conditional, withdrawn from the record, or did not relate to this case. And for example, I believe Judge Griffith pointed this out. At no point when a request was made for additional time was the length of the request point out to the court, nor the likelihood of favorable evidence that would be found. For example, with Hardinero.
Because the judge had said there'd be no continuances.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the judge revisited his initial ruling that there would absolutely be no continuances by the fact that he granted 6 extra days for defense counsel to cross-examine Ms. Moreno. And furthermore, that when there was a request, and let's say, for example, Hardinero, the ability to go to the restaurant. Well, as the district court noted on the record, the fact that they didn't see Valderrama at the restaurant didn't prove anything. And that can be found at Joint Appendix page 952. And again, this goes back to abuse of discretion. The trial court listened to defense counsel's objections. He then made appropriate rulings. He delayed cross-examination. He adjourned early. He allowed defense counsel to release Valdez's name to anyone in Colombia or the United States to conduct an investigation. And that can be found at Joint Appendix page 665. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
January 29th, when he orally amended his order.
That was as to Mr. Valdez. And Mr. Moreno, they allowed to release the name to a Colombian investigator.
Just based on your familiarity with the record, the district court's order indicated that these pseudonyms would exist and continue absent further order of the court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
the applications made?
Your Honor, that's exactly correct. On the first day of trial, the trial court said that he would consider sidebar requests for leave to release the names. And when those requests were made, they were granted, and that can be seen for the example of Mr. Moreno.
What I'm dealing with the January 29th amendment, where any request for leave made by defense counsel about disclosure to investigators in Colombia.
The request was made and it was given that Mr. Valdez...
January 29th.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's the appropriate date.
First request?
With the exception of Mr. Moreno, which was granted, I believe, on the 25th.
I'm just trying to establish that the order gave defense counsel an opportunity to come back to the judge and say, we need some leeway here, specifically X, Y, and Z. And what I could find only was that this came up January 29th, not before then.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The January 25th reference is into the discussion with Chambers, in which that was the arrangement with the Colombian prosecutor and the reinsertado director. And again, page Joint Appendix page 661 to 662 shows that, again, district court said we left it where you were supposed to let me know, and you didn't. And so,
you're saying that the proposal that was made in response to my questions of 3 months, that was Judge Robertson wasn't given that proposal?
Not that I'm aware of on the record, Your Honor. I didn't see that. And if anything, there was no indication as to how much time would be needed or what would be found. And therefore, the appellants cannot establish prejudice here.
Other than the fact that perhaps it wasn't requested, can you help me think through what would have been an appropriate period of time to conduct this investigation? You think that Thursday before a Monday is sufficient?
Your Honor, I submit in this...
Given that the investigation needs to take place in a war zone?
Your Honor, I submit that the investigation here, while difficult and challenging, was adequate. And the reason why is that the defense counsel had time to review these materials, and they had the ability to ask the court for additional time.
So you're saying, so they get it on Thursday, they have until Monday. That's sufficient time to conduct an investigation?
At a minimum, Your Honor, and when it wasn't district court.
So tell me, how do they conduct the investigation? They get it on Thursday. Show me what their life is like to conduct the investigation.
Well, I believe that they were able to hire Colombian investigators, which they did in this case.
Pick up the phone and call their investigators and say what? You've got 3 days to find out about this. Is that the investigation? Or?
I think that they would need to release the names of people to try to find out their argument is their credibility of these witnesses. And I submit that they were able to attack the credibility of these witnesses so that there was no prejudice.
Added time. Did they ask for added time with respect to Moreno?
They did, and it was granted, Your Honor.
How much time did they ask for and what was granted?
I don't know if they specified an exact amount of time, but the district court granted 6 days and actually allowed counsel to have more time, but they chose to conduct cross-examination on the 31st.
Okay.
And if I may...
As far as you're concerned, does that get rid of the issue altogether?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so, and I think that the standards are very strict here. I don't think the district court abused his discretion, and I don't think that the appellants have established prejudice that the district court did. And furthermore, just to, you know, the materials that they reviewed and were able to effectively make use of by pointing out to the jury failure to mention their clients' names, accuracy, truthfulness. Ms. Valderrama was able to establish that Hardenero had lied for the 20 years of his drug trafficking career. Tortures, kidnappings, other crimes. They were able to draw all of this out in front of the jury. And the jury was able to assess their credibility and make a determination, and they did that here. And they found the appellants guilty. To clarify for the court about a few statements.
You're going to get to points 3 and 4.
Yeah, okay, Your Honor, I'll move ahead to the use of pseudonyms.
No, you can clarify if you want.
I just wanted to be able to point out the fact that they were given the names, and that's recognized on the record, and that there was no prejudice, again, because of the ability to effectively cross-examine these witnesses. And again, the limitation on a confrontation the right to confrontation, is exclusion of all investigation into an area. And we didn't have that here.
Well, that's the easy case. It doesn't have where a judge prohibits any inquiry into a particular line that is relevant and material.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. That's the easy case. But that's not the only circumstance in which there can be an abuse.
I believe that Your Honor is possibly referring to a limitation of the cross, and that didn't happen here because the one issue that I believe counsel brought up was the limitation on Valdez's statement. And again, Valderrama.
I understand it. That's all I'm clear here, and that's why I was asking you the questions about the record. The district court entered his order. He said you can't learn the true names now. But you can come back to me seeking variances to these limitations. So then the real names are disclosed, and counsel can disclose it to the client as well as a defense investigator in this country.
That's correct.
Then when defense comes back to the district court, the district court says, by orally modifying his order, you may disclose the name to an investigator in Colombia.
For Mr. Moreno.
Right.
Yes.
The point, my questions was, they could have done that for any of these witnesses.
That's correct, and in fact they did with Mr. Valdez.
Might not have allowed it, but his order gave them that opportunity to come before him and seek that.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And again, when they did ask for Valdez, it was both released in Colombia and the United States. If I may just briefly touch upon the variance issue.
That number three?
That's four.
That was four, Your Honor. Number three was the use of pseudonyms. Just briefly, again, pseudonyms. Again, no prejudice because able to investigate and effectively cross-examine.
All right,
okay, with variance, Your Honor, the case law in this circuit, I believe, is very strong for the common source, which we have, the common goal, which we have, as Celis conceded.
Celis was getting drugs in one of number seven in your brief, getting drugs from a Mexican source as distinct from Mrs. Valderrama?
I actually believe he was trying to purchase them on behalf of a Mexican individual, and that he was trying to arrange Valderrama as the source for that cocaine.
Your chart on page 65, I can see where you have listed the defendant's names, obviously. Mm-hmm. But when I went back to your record sites, I couldn't always find evidence that in all seven instances, the drugs were to come to the United States. Not whether they did come, but that the plan was for them to come. All right, so number one, it's clear. Number two, it's clear. Number three, it's clear. Number four?
Number four would have been the air shipment. There was two 400 kilograms and one 800 kilogram shipment.
But how do we know they're coming to the United States?
Well, I believe that, if I may, Your Honor, just take one moment here to try to collect my
All
thoughts.
Right. Well, I'll just tell you, that's one thing I was trying to tie down.
Right.
That one. In the number five in your list, I found that one. I don't know if it's six or seven, but it's the 420 kilos going to the Bahamas. I didn't find that going to the U.S. And then the 3,000 kilos through Mexico.
Well, Your Honor, if I may,
I looked at your joint appendix sites, and I just don't find evidence that those drugs were coming to the United States.
If I may, with the 3,000 kilograms through Mexico, there was the testimony from Mr. Anthony Placido about how drugs going through Mexico is up to the United States. So I believe there'd be
your joint appendix sites, and it's not there.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. We can supplement with the appropriate references to Mr. Placido's testimony. With respect to...
Can you make a reference to the appendix site right now so that we have it at the time of the argument?
I'm trying to remember where Mr. Placido testified.
There's one of your co-counsel.
How do you spell his name?
Placido, Anthony.
Okay.
And he was earlier on about, very early on in the joint.
And what about the 420 kilos to Venezuela? That's going to the lab.
The 420 kilos to Venezuela, if my recollection serves me correctly, Mr. Moreno had testified that the agreements were to send the the cocaine to the United States. So I believe that that answers the question for the 420.
They were going first to the lab and then going to the United States, and that's Marino's testimony?
I believe that it was, I do have the joint appendix page. It's page 182 for Mr. Anthony Placido's testimony about the drugs. And I apologize for not having that readily accessible. The 420 kilos to Venezuela, I believe early on in Mr. Moreno's testimony with, and I do know that this is cited in the joint appendix, I believe it's page 504 to 507. And that was where Mr. Moreno testified that, that all of the cocaine was being supplied by Valderrama for Mr. Moreno's drug shipments and that they were destined for the United States.
All right, but it's his testimony that's key here on that point.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, just to point out, to get back to the variance issue.
Now what about counsel's argument that there's no, that you may have a source and spokes, but you don't have a rim?
Your Honor, I believe that the record makes clear that there was interdependence among these individuals and that there was overlap. And that can be seen from the fact that you have brokers, you have people who are responsible for the transportation aspect of this cocaine going up to the United States, and they all relied on each other. And that can be explicitly seen in the conversation between Alvarez and Geraldo, that they needed Geraldo's roots. And again, or excuse me, Salas's roots. And I'd like to just briefly point the court's attention to Joint Appendix page 1112 to 13. And that's where Alvarez and Geraldo discuss the fact that if this debt is resolved, Alvarez asks whether Salas will have healthy roots to the U.S. So, again, that shows that that conversation was indeed in furtherance of the conspiracy, but moreover, that they're all relying on one another, that they need each other's contacts, and therefore there is interdependence and overlap. And moreover, even if this court were to find a variance, which we don't deem that there is one, that any error would be harmless. And that's because of you've got the instructions to the jury and also independent and substantial evidence of each defendant's guilt. I see that my time is coming to a close, so unless the court has any further questions, the government will rest on its brief for the remaining issues. And if I may, in conclusion, like to point out that most of the arguments raised by the appellants on appeal require very stringent standards, either plain error or abuse of discretion resulting in prejudice. And we submit that the appellants did not prove or establish that prejudice here today. And in fact, the record makes clear that the trial court considered defense counsel's objections, the requests for continuances. He carefully evaluated those decisions and that he acted as a gatekeeper and protected the defendant's rights in rendering the decisions.
Can I just refer you to the reply brief filed by defendant Valderrama
mm-hmm.
on page 3.
Okay.
I can read the relevant part. This is the statement, the government, quote, the government withheld production of discovery in its possession, which included DEA sixes and various Colombian statements detailing Valdez's own illegal activities and other impeaching evidence until 3 weeks into trial, period, citing transcript and record references. Is that a misstatement in your view?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And I believe that that was material that was produced, again, with sufficient, it was produced with sufficient time for counsel to review and make effective use
okay,
at trial.
But I just want to know, this is a statement that discovery, as well as the DEA sixes, were not disclosed until 3 weeks into trial. Now, is that correct?
I don't know, Your Honor, in terms of the discovery. There was 18 rounds of discovery pretrial. In terms of the DEA sixes,
but
that would have...
counsel, this is clearly stated in the brief, all right? So I mean, that's a very troubling statement. And I wanted to be sure if that is, in the government's view, an accurate statement.
That is not a judgment question. That's a question of fact.
Right.
And that's an inaccuracy, that there was discovery was not withheld from defense counsel at any point in this trial.
What about the DEA-6s?
All DEA-6s were disclosed.
When?
They were disclosed for Moreno, I believe, on the 22nd.
Now, this has to do with Valdez.
Valdez, they were, as counsel conceded on the record, they were produced the Thursday before he testified.
Right. See, what I'm not clear about the government's argument, and I'm sorry to my colleagues, but I just need to be clear about this. I thought your position was that the government, consistent with its Brady and Giglio obligations, had disclosed during discovery. And these are my words, not your words.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that did not pose any security problems, and if it did pose security problems, the materials were redacted.
That's correct, Your Honor. That the material was provided.
The only thing that was not turned over prior to the first day of trial mm-hmm. was the impeachment evidence.
The Jenks and the impeachment evidence. That's correct.
Ignore
Your Honor.
Jenks.
Okay.
Impeachment evidence that's discoverable under Brady.
That's correct. It was turned over in the first day of trial.
And is that because of a security concern?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Why is it a security concern if it's redacted? I'm a little puzzled about
that. Well, she's drawing a distinction between redacted and non-redacted.
Are you talking about the redacted stuff or the non-redacted?
The redacted materials were provided on the first day of trial. The unredacted were provided 7 days before the witness testified.
That's what we're having trouble with. Why the redacted material wasn't disclosed prior to the first day of trial. And do you have any explanation for that?
Your Honor, if I may, I do have trial counsel here. I can confer very briefly as to...
helpful.
Okay. Your Honor, the redacted material was provided when it was on the first day of trial to ensure that they would have time to start reviewing those materials. And then the unredacted with full names was provided.
That's not responsive.
No. In other words,
that's not responsive to Judge Rogers' question. So the question is, why wasn't redacted material provided long before the first day of trial? There's no security concern at all. If I understand correctly.
Excuse me one moment. Okay. Your Honor, trial counsel indicates that the materials provided contained so much specific detailed information that they were still concerned about security issues, and that's
what I
yes.
Said.
I apologize for not being more direct previously.
All this was put on the record for the district court.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court says, "I'm sure the government's going to turn this evidence over," and then I couldn't find where it had actually been turned over.
It's obviously for each witness. It depends on the record sites,
I'm talking
but
about earlier.
Oh, that's Joint Appendix page 70 to 71.
Right. Yeah, that statement was made, but then it didn't happen until a few days before the witness testified. In other words, there was a pretrial motion and demand for Brady.
Correct.
Giglio. And the district court said, I'm sure the government's going to turn this over.
And it did.
But it wasn't turned over until a few days before the witness testified, i.e. 3 weeks into trial. As distinct from where we're talking up on page JA 70-71 at the very beginning.
Well, I would submit that it was provided again, and I do draw a distinction between the redacted and the unredacted form.
And so I'm clear
yes,
that if I go back to the record, I am going to find a representation by the government that all of the materials that were not handed over pursuant to the government's Brady obligations, were not disclosed to the defense counsel prior to trial because of security concerns.
I believe the student in motion in limine sets forth the facts for those security issues.
The in limine motion sets forth the facts for why the names of the witnesses can't be testified, can't be identified. It doesn't go into what we're discussing now, which is redacted information.
Your Honor, my recollection from the record is
that... In other words, I gather it's sort of the government's point of view that if they turned over the redacted information, the defendant could have figured out who the witness actually was.
Yes.
All right, and those were the witnesses covered in the in limine motion.
Correct.
Is that basically... I'm not trying to put... Just trying to cut to the chase here, but
sure.
Is that the nature of what you understand the government's security concern to be?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That there was enough detail in there to be able to find out who the witnesses were. And again, you know, you're still early on in trial. It's going to go. The security at that time is a bit heightened, you know, with people about to take the stand. And I think that that's established in the record as well by Mr. Faulkner's statement, which was taken out of context, that not was it that they were making sure that no continuance would be possible, but more so that trial was going to go before disclosure of all the names occurred, in the sense that if it was put off for 6 months or what have you, there would still be security issues.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Counsel, we'll give you a minute here.
Your Honor, my co-counsel have given me all their rebuttal time.
All right. So you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Number one,
I say that only because we've gone way over the time.
I understand.
All of our questions.
And I appreciate it. Your Honor, the government mischaracterizes and misreads the record. I understand Ms. Mogavero was not trial counsel, and this is an extensive record, and it's convoluted. We did not get all the redacted material before trial began. And I cited in my brief, as the court read, and I will cite, number one, we did not get all the redacted material. Number two, I was cross-examining from redacted material. Valdez on the...
Did you get the redacted material the first day of trial?
No, we did not. We
got... Before trial?
No. Valdez and Moreno are nowhere, their name or their existence, nowhere in the pretrial record. It is true. We got 13 rounds of discovery. The government sought exclusion of times under the Speedy Trial Act for 2 years. My client was arrested in February of 2004, brought to the United States in 2005. They got speedy trial complex case exclusions for 2 years. And all the discovery pre-trial did not once mention Moreno or his stories, did not once mention Valdez or his stories. Nothing. The first time I find out about Valdez is the Thursday before trial, when the government files a 404B motion and says, this person, whose name we won't disclose, whose location we won't tell you where he is, on a date undefined, unidentified, claims that your client ordered him to massacre 10 people. I file a motion for continuance, say it's Brady material if he is a murderer. Mr. Valdez was a sniper for the FARC.
What did the judge do?
Nothing. And on the day when he signed the pseudonym order, which the government said, we're not producing until you sign, I said, Your Honor, I object. I want release from the order right now so can I investigate? Never, never once. To say that I did not ask, I didn't ask, excuse me. Valdez, the first, when I finally, and I apologize, but this is, to say that it was given to us is just, I understand she doesn't know the record. I don't believe she's mischaracterizing it on purpose, but I would be happy to set out for the court, beyond what I've already set out, the dates when we got the documents. Here is on January 25th a.m., and I stand up and I say, Your Honor, I know you love me complaining every morning. The judge said, it is like my morning coffee. kind of wakes me up, and I say, I understand that Mr. McNeil handed over some jinx on the guy who allegedly carried out the 9 murders. He handed it this morning. I haven't read it. I don't know what's in it. I'm asking for a continuance. I have a brief due on Sunday or Monday and all sorts of other work. I never filed a brief. The court's response is, good morning. Mr. Redereta completed his cross-examination because he's called the jury in. This is every morning I would stand up and say, Your Honor, this or that or the other thing, and he would, the way to shut me up, or, and I don't say this disrespectfully. I mean, he was not disrespectful to me, but he was obsessed with keeping the trial going, as he would call the jury in, and that was the end of that request for a continuance. I had to get permission from the court in a in-chambers conference to disclose the name, not the name, because I still didn't know it, I don't believe, to talk to the federal public defender, who was then represented Pineda, to see if they had any information about this gentleman who claimed all sorts of things, not just the murders and the massacres, which, by the way, are not mentioned anywhere in the document about my client having ordered it, although he does mention murders and all sorts of other things. So I had to get permission. The government's proposal is that I talk to a Colombian prosecutor. That was permission number one. Talk to a Colombian prosecutor. I say I've never understood that an investigation under the Sixth Amendment is precluded to asking the government to give me information. But nonetheless, if that's all you're giving me, I will do it. I called the prosecutor. I came back to court and I said, the prosecutor tells me that that my client, Ms. Valderrama, is not implicated in any massacres or murders in Colombia, and that Valdez has never said anything about massacres or murder. So I say to the judge, now, even with this information, there's even more reason for me to conduct an investigation. He still does not. That's on the 25th, I believe. He still does not grant the investigation. They then tell me, we recess for trial on Thursday. On Friday, they give me access to a Colombian general or colonel who's in charge of the Reinsertado program. I talk to the man, very nice. All he can tell me is general information about the program. He says nothing about the person. I come back to court. I still don't have permission to do an investigation on a man who's claiming that my client ordered murders. I never touched that because the judge left that hanging over my head throughout his cross-examination. In my opinion, it was a lie, according to the prosecutors in Colombia, another huge lie which I could not confront him with. To say that I cross-examined these people, absolutely. I cross-examined on a wing and a prayer, and I'm based on my experience as a criminal defense attorney. That's not what the...
Did he testify? I'm a little confused. Did he testify that your client had ordered these murders?
No, that was because I didn't ask, and the government was precluded from asking, but it was left hanging over my head that if I opened the door, they could bring it out. Now I have this apparent evidence that he's lying about that. There's nothing in the documents that I received from the government that's, except once the DEA start talking to
him. You had introduced that to impeach the witness. You would have taken an enormous risk. The jury would have thought, oh my God, she's ordered murders.
But I didn't even have, but I had nothing to.
My point is, I don't see the prejudice, because I can't imagine any intelligent lawyer introducing that as impeachment. For fear that the substance would be damaging to your.
Dynamite
to your clients. I'm very unpersuaded by this.
Well, but he's lying about it. Everything I have at this point is that he's lying about it. Your Honor, he's lying about so many things.
I understand, counsel, but you understand my point.
Well, I agree. But the point is, after I come back and say, Your Honor, I still need to investigate. On the eve of his testimony, the court says, go ahead and investigate. And then said, of course, I understand it's like cleaning the aging stables. So we all knew that there would be no investigation when I'm supposed to cross-examine him the next morning in Colombia. The Brady was not disclosed, Your Honor.
All right.
Well, I have a couple of more items that the government just completely misspoke. And I asked the court to allow us to set out for the court in a post-brief document all the misstatements. They're just completely wrong. She just completely
was
wrong.
We'll take that under advisement, all right, counsel? And we'll take the case under advisement.
May I answer one question?
One quick answer.
Your Honor, you asked what the standard is. The Supreme Court long ago in Roe v. Arrow set down the law. If the government wants to protect a witness, they may, but they cannot prosecute.
Thank you. All right, we will take the case under advisement. I want to ask, state on behalf of the court to Mrs. Hernandez, and to Mrs. Amato, and to Mr. Retirata. If I mispronounced your name, I apologize, but you were appointed by the court, and we appreciate your assistance. And I also want to thank the prosecutor, all right, for assisting the court. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.